everybody. My name is Toni Rialli, and I am the Coastal Program Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And as part of my position, I manage a diverse network of environmental advocates, local elected officials, academics, renewable energy business owners, farmers, and even entrepreneurs from Maryland to Louisiana. What you see on your screen is one of our networks, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, and our network is dedicated to fostering regional leadership in mitigating and adapting to the challenges of global warming. This network promotes protection of the Southeast's uniquely vulnerable coastal resources by increasing local, state, and national awareness of the threats and opportunities posed by climate change. And the host organization for the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And if you're not already a member, you can find the link on the screen. And if you are in Florida, we have a sister group called the Florida Climate Alliance. And if any of you don't have a chance to write that down, feel free to email me at Toni, T-O-N-I, at cleanenergy.org. I'm happy to be on the call today with Daniela from ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability. And this is actually the fifth webinar in a series of webinars looking specifically at coastal climate adaptation challenges and opportunities in the Southeast. And recognizing the importance of ensuring that local communities are informed and engaged in climate preparedness, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network partnered with ICLEI. And we've put together a webinar series focusing on all these issues surrounding coastal climate adaptation. If you missed any of our previous webinars on this topic, you can find all of our webinars archived on our website, cleanenergy.org. That's www.cleanenergy.org. And if you go to multimedia and webinars, you will then find our archived webinars. And there are some other kinds of webinars as well in the realm of climate and clean energy issues. So I'm now going to actually introduce Daniela Hirschfeld, who works as a program officer in ICLEI's Climate Programs Division, building climate adaptation tools, resources, and trainings for local governments throughout the country. Prior to joining ICLEI in August, Daniela held a two-year NOAA Coastal Zone Management Fellowship, during which time she worked in Massachusetts communities to prepare for and adapt to sea level rise. So, Daniela, can you please give us a little insight as to what ICLEI does and what your position with ICLEI is, and then I will introduce Dr. Obey.
Absolutely. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be on the phone with you all today. ICLEI is, you kind of can see on the slide here, but it's an international association of local governments. And internationally, we have over 1,100 communities. And local governments, in this case, are defined sort of anything ranging in scale from a single municipality to a region or group of municipalities, counties, et cetera. Within the U.S., we have over 600 members, and over about half of the U.S. population falls within an ICLEI local government. And what we do with these local governments, really our goal is to provide technical assistance, consulting, training, webinars of exactly this nature on a range of things from greenhouse gas mitigation to climate change adaptation. We recently launched our Climate Resilient Communities Program, where we have a tool online for any member organization to go through 5 milestones to adapt to climate change. And we have 8 inaugural communities throughout the U.S. that are committed to this particular effort, as well as many others that are looking to join. And my role is to, essentially provide all of that particular technical assistance and to help with webinars and other events. I'm working on specific projects with one in a community in Lewis, Delaware, another one in San Diego on regional climate change adaptation. So it's a pleasure to be with you all, and I look forward to this presentation.
Great, thank you. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Obey, who is the director of the Office of Modeling at the South Florida Water Management District and has over 20 years of experience practicing water resources engineering with an emphasis on stochastic and deterministic modeling. Hopefully you can explain to us what that is specifically. And furthermore, Dr. Obey was recently quoted in a great article that I sent around to all of our Southeast Coastal Climate Networks on the future impacts of sea level rise on South Florida. And so we are very thankful for your time here today, Dr. Obey, and we are very much looking forward to what you have to say.
All right. Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon or good morning, everybody, depending on where you are. I hope everybody can hear me well.
Yes.
And I first want to thank the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and ICLEI for inviting me to give this webinar and share our experience and the current state of knowledge on this difficult subject. And we've been working on climate change and sea level rise for some time, but today I'll be focusing primarily on the sea level rise. And I want to thank Tony and Daniela and also David for organizing this and facilitating this. Just quickly about myself, I'm a director of a modeling group at the South Florida Water Management District, a regional water management agency. More specifically for this talk, I'm also a technical lead for climate change and sea level rise in our agency. Our group, about 60 in size, we do computer modeling for Everglades restoration and all aspects of water management in our agency, system-wide and more regional modeling support for various projects in the agency. Next, please. Today, the outline, I'm going to talk about, as I mentioned, the sea level rise and water management, but my focus is more on regional issues, not specifically on very specific local issues that a particular municipality or county might be dealing with. But I'll touch on some of the climate issues as well as we go along. I want to first talk about this topic of attribution of climate events. You will see some of the recent events and this new science called attribution that's coming out. Then also I'll get into the difficulties of projecting sea level rise and the uncertainties associated with that and the need for local coordination and agreement on the sea level rise projections. And finally, I'll talk about the vulnerabilities and adaptation challenges in dealing with managing water resources at the scale. Next, please. Just starting with these slides, actually this came from a great website that you all may want to see. It's from the federal government, part of the United States Global Change Research Program. Basically, what you see here are all the parameters or the variables that that we have observed changes in. Every arrow in this slide or in this picture have data behind it. And you see these are the signs of a warming world. Besides the increase in carbon dioxide and the temperature you see at the upper right-hand corner, you have data to show that the air temperature is increasing in the troposphere, humidity is increasing, ocean heat content and temperature are increasing, sea level is increasing, and basically temperature over land is also increasing. And the black colored arrows show things which are going in the downward direction, again, signs of the warming world. The snow cover and the glaciers and particularly the sea ice, as you may have read in 2007, we had the lowest extent of sea ice in the Arctic. So associated with all this is the sea level rise. Sea level rise is one aspect of climate change that we are trying to deal with. Next, please. So in terms of water management, we put together this concept, what we call a very high-level conceptual model. On the left-hand side, you have two boxes entitled natural cycles and human-induced box. On the natural cycles, we cannot ignore, when we talk about the climate change and variability, we cannot ignore the cycles or intradecadal or multi-decadal changes in climate. And then it turns out that even the sea level rise will observe or experience effects of these cycles. And then you have the more important, the discussion we have recently about human-induced changes. And you cannot ignore the land use changes having climate feedbacks. And the topic of discussion recently intensely is the greenhouse gases or global warming. And the issue that we are now very familiar with is how these natural cycles might be impacted or changed by the human-induced aspects of climate change. So for water management, we identified what we call stresses, or quadrant of change in the middle box. And there are four of them we identified. The first one, the topic of discussion today, is the rising seas or rising sea levels, which is what I call a clear and present danger. It's already here, and it's already affecting us. And there are other aspects of climate change, temperature, rainfall, floods and droughts, and tropical storms and hurricanes that are important to us. We have some understanding of these other three parameters and what to expect, but I feel like globally there may be a lot of good information, but regionally we still don't have sufficient information to act on, and I think we are waiting for the research and the modeling to come out. So I'll be talking more about rising sea level or rising seas aspect of climate change. On the right hand side, you see the water management impacts in terms of our mission, the direct landscape impacts, basically storm surges affecting coastal wetlands, coastal areas or urbanized regions. Then more importantly for our mission, the water supply impacts in terms of droughts or, you know, saltwater intrusion, flood control impacts, urban flooding and hurricanes and natural systems. Particularly the ecosystem impacts in the light of the Everglades restriction we are embarking on, the effect on the natural systems are very important. So I'm going to elaborate more on these impacts and some of the adaptation strategies we have started looking at. Next slide, please. I borrowed these slides from the United Nations IPCC document, I believe. And these red boxes indicate the various sources of sea level rise. Let me start with the vertical land movement. And this is more in relation to the local relative sea level rise. There may be vertical land movement due to tectonic effects or movements. And then it also could be due to human activities like groundwater pumping, subsidence, sedimentation, and others. And believe it or not, what happened 20,000 years ago in terms of since the last glacial maximum, the Earth is still elastically expanding in what is known as the isostatic adjustment, and the world is, or the Earth's surface is still deforming due to the deglaciation. So those are the land movement aspects of sea level rise. And then the terrestrial water input on the other upper left-hand corner, basically the changes in the groundwater, changes in the water storage could impact how much water is coming into the ocean, and it could be plus or minus. And then the thermal expansion being the big one right now, for example, because of the warming, obviously the water is expanding, and that could induce, contribute to sea level rise. But the big unknown is the one on the upper right-hand side, the melting of ice in the glaciers or ice sheets in these polar regions like Greenland and Antarctica. And this is the big unknown, and that has a lot to do with our ability or uncertainty in projecting future rising sea level. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later on. But that, I think, it's expected that, or the scientists have shown that there's a recent acceleration of this melting of ice in the glaciers and the ice sheets. And I think this is something we really have to learn a little bit more if we have to predict the sea level rise with some confidence or reliability. Next slide, please. So there's a lot of newspaper cuttings in this slide. Basically, we're going to be asked the question, when we see evolving climatic condition, like the ones we have seen last few months or this summer in this part of the country, in the South Florida, we've seen had the hottest summer ever, steaming in South Florida. You see all these newspaper headings, South Florida driest October on record, and then other places like Los Angeles and even this article about water cycles. So the question comes up, what do you attribute this to? Or is it natural variability or global warming? And the question is, who done it? And this little cartoon in the middle. Next slide, please. I'm going to show you a series of slides showing some indications of basically during high tide, what happens to the coastal regions of South Florida. This is an actual picture that one of my colleagues here took in the morning last month, pretty much, water coming through the storm sewer system into the coastal roads, basically flooding. This is not rainwater flooding, basically tidal flooding coming through the storm sewer system. Next slide, please. Thanks to our colleague from Broward County, this is a picture of one of their streets in that county, again, during last month, during high tide when the moon is in the right phase, during high tides, what's happening to their street. And the next slide. And this is the same situation, but in further south in Miami-Dade County, you see the water coming up to the houses, people having to walk on the streets, in water or walk on little pavements and the flooding in parks. So the real question is, this is a natural occurrence, or are we seeing more and more of this at a higher frequency in the recent past due to 9 to 10 inches of sea level rise we have seen observed in the last century. Next slide, please. So there is this new science called attribution science. Basically, we've seen the same type of climatic events globally, floods in Pakistan or Russia or China. And ENCA and some of the scientists in other agencies in NOAA have initiated this new area called attribution science. Basically, science thing or detecting a change, whether it's human-induced or natural variability. And why is it important to us? We need to know whether it's an oscillating cycle that's creating these changes, or is it a gradual increasing change? And when we are investing resources on adaptation strategies, it's good to know what do we attribute these events to, whether it's human-induced activities or natural variability. So I would encourage everyone to take a look at this website on the lower right-hand side of the slide, and also basically some results of this attribution workshop that I was able to attend, and the new science that is coming out. Basically, the press is asking, what do you attribute this to? And it's an important area for us to get engaged in. Next slide, please. At the South Florida Water Management District, my agency, we have an interdepartmental working group. We published a white paper. If you want to get a copy, there is a web link at the bottom of the slides. And our approach is we realize there are a lot of uncertainties. And when we ask our decision makers to spend sometimes millions or even billions of dollars, you really need to have some reliable information they can act on. So we try to come up with two important questions. The question number one is, what decisions are likely to be affected but could benefit from some adaptation strategies in the near term? And these are what we call no-regret strategies. This is not a phrase that I coined, but it seems like very fitting that, you know, we will not regret these type 1 adaptation strategies. So the key is to identify them. And then the second question is, what decisions are likely to be affecting us, but we can wait on those adaptation strategies because we need better science and we could defer those without serious consequences. And I call them type 2 adaptation strategies. So the key right now and for us, we are focusing on these type 1 adaptation strategies. Please. As I mentioned, in terms of projecting sea level rise, this polar ice sheet uncertainty is the big one, and you see this on the left-hand side, the Greenland, and on the right-hand side, Antarctica, and a very large percentage of fresh water is tied up in these two regions, and there is enough water in there to basically raise the sea level rise by meters. For example, in Antarctica, the western shelf is more vulnerable to breaking off, and this, you know, breaking off could be due to ice sheet dynamics, and also the surface melting. If it is higher than the snowfall that may be happening, that may also contribute fresh water into the ocean. And there's enough water in there to raise the sea level, and you probably couldn't believe it, but there's enough water in there. So the western shelf itself, in a previous presentation, you may see that the western shelf could have enough water to raise the sea level by about 5 to 6 meters, and the eastern shelf area in the Antarctica has enough water to raise the sea level by 60 meters, according to the third IPCC report. And Greenland has similar amount of water, about 5 to 6 meters. So the melting or future melting of this is very important to us in terms of knowing what's going to be the sea level rise possible over the next 100 years or 200 years. And as you know, the scientists are doing a lot of research on this, and the indication is that there is an acceleration of the melting of this the ice in the ice sheets, particularly in the last 5 to 15 years, where we have very important satellite altimetry data, and also GRACE, the experiment called GRACE, and there's a lot of information to provide accurate information on the mass of this ice sheet. So the indications are that this is the melting of these ice sheets are accelerating. And there's no debate on that, but the question is at what rate, I think, is an important question to us. Although we are not scientists, we need to know enough to know how much we can expect. Next slide, please. So this graphic, you know, we put together, you know, what you see as a red dot are actually the Key West location, which has one of the longest tide records in the country. And then the green dots on the left-hand side are the global sea level rise, which happens about 3 to 3.3 millimeters per year. So depending on this acceleration of the ice melting, it could be one of the three curves on the right-hand side. It could be a continuing trend at a linear rate, or a medium acceleration, or rapid acceleration. And so the question is which curve we would be following. And so we kind of decided in our agency to not to focus on the future dates, although some of you may need to. So our planning horizon is about 50 years, so we kind of decided to focus on the next 50 to 60 years time horizon. Next slide, please. This graphic shows all the data that we were able to put together about a year ago, and I'm not going to go through each one of them. Various agencies have come up with these estimates, National Research Council, IPCC, which has been, judged to have underestimated the sea level rise because they didn't account for the ice sheet dynamics adequately. We have the Miami-Dade County estimates 3 to 5 feet, and Broward County has another 2 to 4 feet estimate here. The important issue is there's a lot of spread in the data, and so I mentioned that we're going to focus on 2060 as our planning horizon in the middle. For now, until better estimates become available, we decided to plan for 5 to 20 inches of sea level rise by 2060, and that may change as the new science become available. As you will see later on, this is even too much of a sea level rise for us in some cases. Next slide, please. Can you go back on that slide, please? There's one important aspect. Oh, go back on that slide, please. One more, yes. Sorry about that. You see this little text on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side? This is becoming a very difficult decision strategy or decision problem for the decision makers. In the next few decades, you'll be thinking about what is our resilience, what is our adaptive capacity, what are the no-regret strategies and adapt sort of management strategies that will be suitable for the next few decades. But out in the future decades, by 2080 and 2100, if you're looking at these types of sea level rise estimates, then you'll be thinking about what are alternative futures for the coastal region, what are the contingency plans. So trying to make decisions, under this type of uncertainty is very difficult. And I saw a report this morning, some town in California is already thinking about managed retreat. And that's what you will be thinking about in the future decade. So for us, this is a very difficult decision problem, and you need a sort of a decision matrix when to do certain things. Next slide, please. This is the sea level rise curves published by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They have a national guidance. You see the number there. It's available. They went through a similar effort and came up with three curves. They call low curve and an intermediate curve and a high curve. It was all based on some work done by the National Research Council in 1987-88 time frame. And this is the curve that they have developed for the Key West location. And their estimate is very similar to ours, but a little higher on the high curve, about 2 feet by 2060. So some of the projects that the Corps of Engineers might be working with the local agency, they might use this national guidance. And this is supposed to be updated by next year. Next slide, please. We should not forget about the extreme sea levels which happened during the storm surges. This yellow curve is the frequency curve, which is basically maximum sea level during an event or a particular year. But on the horizontal axis, you see the average event in years. Basically, frequency curve, and when the mean sea level is rising, the extreme will also rise. And the point I want to make is that the 100-year storm event due to storm surge might be once in 8 years storm event, frequency being a lot higher, or the return period being a lot smaller because of the sea level rise. And this is important for coastal work. Next slide, please. One of the things that we are working on in this region, and we have this great arrangement where the four counties, Broward, Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach have gotten together, have this Southeast Climate Compact. And we have a technical working group consisting of all these participants, and the idea is you really have to have a unifying local projection so that we can use them as a common set of planning parameters. Otherwise, we'll end up having different estimates of projection which is not very efficient. And we're going to try to base this on peer-reviewed science. Next slide, please. We follow in this adaptation planning strategy. Actually, it came from Maryland Department of Natural Resources. If you want to go through their website, and they've done a lot of work on adaptation. Basically, the basic sequence is we review the state of science, assess climate vulnerability, identify critical information gaps, and basically develop, prioritize key issues of concerns, and then explore potential adaptation strategies, and ending up with basically short-term, medium, and long-term strategies. And this seems like a very useful set of planning steps that anyone could follow in terms of developing adaptation strategies. Next slide, please. So we developed this vulnerability and adaptation matrix. On the first column, you see the rising sea climate stressor. We have similar matrices for temperature and precipitation. All our mission elements are affected: flood control, water supply, natural systems, and water quality. And then the key vulnerabilities are, we know that our flood control system will be stressed because of sea level rise. And more importantly, the saltwater intrusion will be a greater concern affecting water supply and wetlands. And our adaptation strategies right now, and we're taking a very measured approach in dealing with this. We have what we are exploring right now is what is known as forward pumping, which I will explain in a minute. Then the saltwater intrusion interface, we have some idea where it is. I think we are trying to get a better handle on that. Typically during droughts, we pay attention to it, but that's about the time. But we think that we really need to have good monitoring network and identify the water well fields or utilities that are at risk. And we think that it's more important to emphasize the water conservation strategies right now and explore alternative sources of water supply. We know that the coastal well fields are going to be stressed and impacted, and the importance of water supply for coastal regions is even more in the light of the sea level rise and the saltwater intrusion that could be accompanying that. And we think there should be good regional coordination and incorporate sea level rise in every planning effort. Next slide, please. This is sort of an animation to kind of demonstrate the flood control issue. As you'll see, when it rains, typically we can open the gate and you can let the water out of urbanized area. Everything is fine. We can provide this level of flood protection or maintain the canal levels to prevent the saltwater intrusion. But under sea level rise scenario, even now, sometimes we cannot open the gates. And if it rains during those times, we have a big problem of flood protection. As you can see, there are times even now we cannot open the gates during high tide, and which means that the sea level rise, which has already happened in this region, is impacting our flood control infrastructure on the coastal canals. Next slide, please. What we did was we did a very preliminary analysis. We have a very large number of coastal structures along the coastal regions of South Florida. This green, yellow, red structures indicate the color schemes you use to indicate the vulnerability. And most of the structures in Miami-Dade and Broward County in the red category. Basically, what we did was we looked at how they were designed 50, 60 years ago, and they were not probably designed with the current sea level rise, which has already occurred, in mind. And so they only had like half a foot of head difference or water level difference under design storm conditions. And that half a foot is pretty much already gone, and that's why we are seeing in some cases we cannot open the gates. So we identified three preliminary structures which are mostly have the highest vulnerability, and this is a very rough analysis, and we plan to follow up with more detailed studies to understand the level of protection we may have, we now have compared to what we had at the time they were constructed. So this is kind of a real big concern for this. Do we have the level of protection we thought we had 50 to 60 years? And this the solution to this is expensive, as you will see, and this requires a discussion as to what our strategy is to deal with this flood protection issue on the coastal regions. Next slide, please. These are the pictures of those structures, gravity drainage structures, and basically very flat land. You know, the availability of land around there is also an issue. So we're trying to, in our development of adaptation strategies, there are many aspects that we need to look at. Next slide, please. Just to indicate the importance of flood protection in this region, these structures are located in heavily urbanized areas in the urbanized coastal regions. You see this from this map, the number of houses and the urbanized, how extensive the urbanization is. So protecting, providing the level of flood protection is extremely important. The next slide, please. This is kind of a more zoomed-in area. Again, you see the structure on the lower right-hand side. The one of the issues is, do we have the land available? And any kind of solution we provide, is that going to be conducive to the neighborhood around that? So there are a lot of unanswered issues that we need to address. But we have found one approach to solving this problem. If you can move on to the next slide, that will basically, the idea is to retain the gravity control structure, but we add what is known as a forward pump, and basically during storm events that the pump would kick in when the gravity structure cannot provide the discharge capacity it used to have. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see a real example of that. We have already installed a couple of these in a couple of areas. You see the new pump station to the right side of the gravity spillway structure. And I should mention that these solutions are not cheap, and it could cost tens of millions of dollars to install, not counting land. So it's not a cheap solution, but at least this is one option that we really need to look at. There are many issues that we need to look at, particularly downstream and upstream of this location, what are the issues that might create by installing these new pump stations. Next slide, please. The next issue is the saltwater intrusion. You see the little diagram on the left-hand side. All those dots are the well fields, and the red line is our best estimate of the saltwater intrusion and the shaded area. And if you could move to the next slide, if you should animate my picture in the little rock. Can you move, hit the arrow key, please? Oops. Maybe double click. Oops, no, that won't work. Anyway, the idea is, you see the rock sample here. This is the kind of rock we have in the aquifer, and it's very porous, like Swiss cheese. So intrusion is a real threat, and the question is, once the sea level rise starts, what would happen to the rate at which the saltwater is intruding? And it's not like the Dutch, we cannot put any walls along the coastal areas because the water will basically come through the aquifer. Next slide, please. The effect on the natural areas is also significant, and this slide shows the potential inundation areas in the southern Everglades, 1 to 2 feet sea level rise, and there could be a range of environmental impacts, the relocation of the mangrove systems, the wading birds moving out of the area, and the important aspect is there's a lot of peat in these areas, organic material. And the current thought is that there will be a significant peat collapse in these areas, and there will be coastal erosion, and also the impact of saltwater intrusion into these wetlands. So a couple of questions have come up. Do we really want to work on any restoration projects in this area if they're going to be inundated anyway? But the other thought, which is more popular, is, you know, what is known as fight water with water. Basically, try to send more fresh water to build up the peat to counter the saltwater intrusion in this coastal margin. So, and I think there's a current thinking is that the Everglades restoration with more fresh water going down to the Everglades National Park is more important. Next slide, please. We've done some modeling. This is showing the modeling we have done on the left-hand side, some of the surface inundation and the coastal regions, again showing the southern Everglades being most vulnerable. On the right-hand side, this is basically the groundwater level increase. One of the solutions is to raise the groundwater table by maintaining higher levels in canals as a countermeasure to at least slow down the saltwater intrusion. But that can only do so much because when you raise the canal levels to have a higher groundwater level, that could impact coastal flood protection, because in this area where the canal levels are, the groundwater levels are a critical factor in determining the flood protection. And I think that so that should be a balance between those two aspects. And that's another thing we should be looking at. To what extent can we increase the maintenance levels of these canals, which will also require more water to do that, to as a countermeasure to solve water intrusion. Next slide, please. One of the things we have done, and again, this is another strategy that anybody can follow, basically develop an adaptation toolbox and have two sets of items in there. One is the data on the left-hand side. Another is the models on the other side. And the data side, we're looking at historical data to see what is the type of trends we have seen in the last 50 to 100 years. Through this Southeast Climate Compact Group, we are trying to get a good understanding of the coastal topography, primarily the LIDAR data. And then we are trying to come up with better sea level rise and storm surge projections. And again, temperature and precipitation projections locally. On the models side, we are developing two types of models, storm event simulation models for the coastal watersheds and also saltwater intrusion models for coastal watersheds. Next slide, please. One of the things that we are trying to do right now, as I mentioned before, is to get a better handle on where the saltwater intrusion is right now, and basically have a mapping of the saltwater intrusion. And for that, we will need a good saltwater intrusion monitoring network. And this is one of those things that we will work with the local agencies to develop, that identify where the gaps are, and basically identify what utilities might be at risk once you develop this. Next slide, please. This is another detailed level of what we are doing, basically taking all the data on the, you know, the slide on the right-hand side, all the data available. We have developed a draft saltwater intrusion maps for the few counties, but in the future we'll be developing for the saltwater intrusion map or extend map for the entire lower west coast as well, and evaluate and make recommendations on the existing monitoring network. See, and our idea is routinely monitor this from now on, so we have some baseline data to see how fast it might be moving. Next slide, please. Our agency is also embarking on accelerating the water conservation measures, continue looking at opportunities for technologies for reducing the amount of water, but also other technologies that are there, for example, in using wastewater as hydraulic barriers. And obviously, this is a technology that we have not explored at the scale, but, you know, we basically want to look at that as an option. Again, mention here the implementation of water conservation measures, alternative water supply options. By the way, this the slide on the lower right-hand side or lower middle is basically the wastewater outfall into the ocean in some parts of Southeast Florida. Next slide, please. And I mentioned the effort to come up with a good digital, the elevation data set, LIDAR data set. And fortunately, there's some data available from the Florida Division of Emergency Management. This digital elevation modeling project will help us improve support for operations and basically modeling efforts, and storm surges, and even around Lake Okeechobee, it will help us to help us in the dike failure study we are conducting, and looking at some of the ecological effects in the southern Everglades system. Next slide, please. This shows where the data status is, all the green dots indicating we've all processed all the data. And one of the things that we have found out through the local coordinated effort, a lot of issues in the data collection in LIDAR data, especially if different groups are collecting this data, there is edge matching issues, quality issues that we really need to spend some time on QA, QC in this data. So we're trying to get together with the local counties to put together regional digital elevation map that has been quality controlled, and also understand the errors. And one of the things we are working actually with the NOAA is to basically use this information and use the error information in the digital elevation data as well as the mean high high water projection data to provide some sort of a confidence band around the mapping that we might be doing in the future. Next slide, please. This is not a very easy effort. This is an example on the Lee County. There are 1,300 tiles we had to mesh together. They have irregular boundaries, very complex and time-consuming effort. So if you're getting into that, that's not an easy effort. Next slide, please. So what are we going to do in the future? We will identify district projects that may be impacted by sea level rise. We are working on a technical report on sea level rise and climate variability that should be available in about 6 months. Complete development of the digital elevation model data set for coastal areas, and complete the evaluation of existing saltwater intrusion monitoring network. And we will embark on annual baseline mapping on the saltwater intrusion. Next slide, please. We are also developing computer models on the first one being the saltwater intrusion modeling that we are going to work with the federal agencies to develop that jointly. We are also developing flood event simulation models, because in this area you cannot model flood event modeling groundwater, so we really need to have joint groundwater surface water models. We are working with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on developing tools for that. And again, this issue of coastal flood protection or spillway structures, we have identified what structures are vulnerable and really need to go to the next phase of developing adaptation strategies and discussing with our governing board and our decision makers what kind of policy we should be adopting in the future to solve these critical issues. Next slide should be the last one. And may have seen this. This is just to kind of end my presentation with this slide from a cabinet meeting in the island nation of Maldives. I think the cabinet wanted to send a message because they have a group of islands and they're very afraid of sea level rise, and they wanted to send the message to the world showing that they have a immediate or clear and present danger, as I would say. With that, I will end my presentation. Thank you for listening.
Dr. Obey, thank you so much. I really like this last image, and I appreciate you sharing your information with us today. We do have a number of questions, and I hope we can get to all of these. I would like to start with Rhonda's question. She asks, can any aspect of Everglades restoration really mitigate for the effects of sea level rise?
I think one school of thought is that the Everglades restoration, the aspect of sending more fresh water towards the Everglades National Park, and one aspect is that the more fresh water you send, it will help build the peat layer. As you know, when you don't have enough fresh water all over the groundwater or water table or water levels, that the peat decomposes, peat organic material. And the more you send adequate water, it will help build up the peat layers in the southern Everglades. And that should The current concept is that probably will help slow down the the effect of saltwater intrusion. The real uncertainty or the scientific question is that can the rate of peat accretion beat the rate of sea level rise? And only, I guess, the time will tell, but it's worth the try. And so that's one aspect. And some of the storages that we are planning as a part of Everglades restoration, particularly if the precipitation is decreasing, and we know that with the increasing temperature, the evapotranspiration or losses will increase. With the additional storage, we may be able to better manage the water resources over a long period of time. So that's another aspect of Everglades restoration that might help. But again, really need to do some analysis with future potential scenarios to see what changes might be needed to account for that.
Thank you. The next question is, will the freshwater supplies in Florida's aquifers be sufficient to support our population if coastal populations migrate inland?
That is a very difficult question, and obviously it is not, and that's why we are emphasizing, particularly during drought times, that's why we are emphasizing water conservation and alternative water supply strategies. In South Florida, you know, we have basically three very important stakeholders. We got the urban population, we got the agricultural sector, we got the natural system, and all of them need water. And during drought times, there's competition for water, and there may not be enough for all of them. And that's the time we really need to exercise water conservation and alternative water supplies.
Okay, very good. What role does South Florida's geology play in vulnerability to sea level rise?
It's a very important role, and as I mentioned, as I showed, that little sample of rock has one of the highest transmissivities or in this aquifer. In other words, the rock looks more like Swiss cheese with lots of pathways and holes in them, and as the sea level is rising, the intrusion of salt water into the freshwater aquifer will be accelerating, and that's the biggest concern. So the geology is very critical for the in terms of the effect of the sea level rise on the salt water intrusion aspect.
Okay, thank you for answering that. You spoke about the pumping forward method of mitigation, and when you pump forward, the question is, aren't you just shifting the flood to another community?
That's a very important question, and I think, you know, I think the real issue is downstream of these structures or pump stations, there may be coastal communities who will still have a segment of the canal before water reaches the ocean that may be affected by the increase of water flowing through that downstream segment of that canal. Something before we implement, we really need to do some good modeling to look at that issue. Are we going to exacerbate the flooding problem for even a small segment of the people downstream of those structures? It needs to be looked at before we implement, particularly on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, thanks. And are Florida communities still spending money on beach renourishment? And kind of a sister question to that is, how will beach renourishment projects sort of figure into this larger adaptation picture?
Our agency is not involved extensively on beach renourishment, and I think it's happening. I think it's an important aspect, particularly in areas affected by coastal erosion. So I think from my point of view, it's a very important activity, at least to slow down some of the effects. But I'm not an expert on that, so I couldn't tell much more about that.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's see. If anybody has any other questions, please go ahead and chat those in. I only have a couple more in my queue here. All right, the next question is an interesting question. Will the increased weight of the water column due to sea level rise lead to potential increased earthquake activity along the continental shelf?
I haven't seen any science to indicate that, but I haven't read anything to suggest that.
Okay.
So from my, that's not something we are looking at. I haven't even read about it.
All right. Let's see here. You said in about 6 months you will have that other report out.
Yes.
And will it be an additional chapter to what you had presented to us before?
It will be more like a technical document. We will look at, it will be a lot of technical information. We are doing some analysis on historical precipitation temperature data. We'll be looking at future projections on regional levels, looking at sea level rise. So it will be primarily a more of a technical document, whereas the white paper I showed on my presentation is more like a high-level vulnerability discussion, but this one is, would be more like quantitative information on the future impacts and effects.
Very good. I would definitely like to invite you back to present to our
mm-hmm.
group on that report. If you have the time, we'd be more than happy to
have
you.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, I think I have one more question here, and it's from Rhonda. And Rhonda has virtually raised her hand. So, Rhonda, if you want to press star 6, you can go ahead and ask your brief question. And this will conclude the question session of our webinar today. So, if Rhonda, you're still on, just press star 6.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes,
I can hear you.
Obi, I can't resist asking this question. To what extent is the district or the agencies with which it works looking at water-intensive central power plants, coal, nuclear, gas, things that require tremendous amounts of water for cooling, and perhaps looking at less water-intensive options as a real water conservation measure?
I'm not working on that, but I believe that, you know, obviously we have to, if I'm not mistaken, we have to issue a permit for the, such water use. And I think having, you know, they have to go through some basic requirements of permitting. I'll have to look into that, you know, whether we are emphasizing water conservation given the, and I'm pretty sure we are, but I don't have that information. But I'll look into that and ask the right people that question. That's a good point that we should be, you know, that should be part of our water conservation strategy. It may very well be, but I just don't have that information with me. I'll follow up on that. It's a good point, Rhonda.
Thank you. We'd really appreciate it. I know Rhonda's group and a lot of us on the phone are particularly interested in kind of hearing about how the energy sector sort of figures into this water management.
That's right. I'll certainly follow up with the water supply folks in my agency on that.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Those of you who are still on, we will archive this webinar on our website, cleanenergy.org, under Multimedia, then Webinar Archives. Dr. Obi, it was really great getting to know you and really appreciate
you
sharing your information and expertise with us today. We hope to have
you
back
for your help.
6 months.
Good.
Okay, thank you so much. Goodbye, everybody.
Okay, bye.